This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Coming up, we've got all the news and views from Manchester City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
So here it is. Merry Christmas. Everybody's having fun at Manchester City's expense. Just when you thought the team had already embarrassed themselves in every possible way in the last few weeks, you find out that actually there are whole new and inventive ways for them to embarrass themselves on the world stage. Leading 1-0 with only a few minutes of a frankly terrible Manchester derby to go, City not only conspired not to win, they threw the whole thing away to gift United both the equaliser and the winner. We're going to discuss that on today's Blue Moon podcast, but we're also going to try and take your mind off it as well. There's only so much you can say about the same old problems rearing their heads once again. With that in mind, we've got the former City midfielder Georgie Kinkladze on the show. He'll be telling us all about his time at Main Road and about that wonder goal against Southampton. And it's Aston Villa and Everton that are up next. So we'll hear from Frankie Maguire from All Villa No Filler and from David Downey from The Blue Room. They'll both tell us how they're going to be taking points off City in the next couple of games. Well then, who are the poor schmucks who have agreed to chat through this week with me? From One Football, we've got Dan Burke.
Hello.
And we're also joined by City fan Casey.
Schmuck number two, hello.
How are you both doing? It's been a week, hasn't it? Okay, see, you all right?
Yeah, I'm full of a cold, City of shit. But yeah, Christmas should be good, so I just got to focus on the positives.
Yeah, just getting through this week, isn't it, basically?
Yeah.
Dan, have you caught the lurgy yet? Are you all right? Or
no, just the Christmas cheer, that's all I've caught. You know, we've had a few days without having to watch City, haven't we? So it's been quite nice, actually.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. The fact that there's been no Carabao midweek defeat has been quite a positive, hasn't it, in the end?
Absolutely.
Paul got in touch to say, just wondered if anyone else is running out of lucky shirts to wear on match days. I'm down to my last two, may have to deploy the White First Advice kit. Still proud that City played a whole season in the Premier League with a bankrupt sponsor on the shirt. Happy days. So with that in mind, I didn't think we're not doing superstitions again, because obviously no amount of superstition in the world is working right now for City. But it's basically a way into classic kits, this. So, Dan, I know I've played football with you a couple of times, and you like the good old Kappa shirt to play in. Is that your classic City shirt?
I think that run of Kappa shirts is unbeatable, to be honest with you. The irony of our worst ever team playing in our best ever kit is not lost on me, and that laser blue one was fantastic. The white and maroon and sort of dark blue away one was really nice as well.
Yes.
I think the 99 kit, I mean, I've got the new version of that. That has sort of grown on me, and I think is kind of iconic because of the match that it was sort of famously associated with. I didn't actually think that much of it at the time. Mm. I preferred that yellow one, the one that was like not commercially available, that was like sort of rushed out because they realised halfway through the season, oh shit, we've got to play teams away from home. We play in blue and both of our kits clash with them. I actually got a version of it from like some Singaporean website last year, which is now one of my favourite things to wear on a match day.
It's yellow and black, isn't it? It's like two yellow bars with the white divide and then one black bar with brother in black, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. It always reminds me, there's a picture of Murtaz Şılaya that always goes around wearing that kit. So I always sort of associate it with him, yeah.
Yeah, I think fitting for this week, I think that was the game where he scored at Birmingham on his debut.
In like
the 90th minute, and they still lost 2-1. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, what a week that was. Casey, any of your favourite City shirts that we've not mentioned?
Well, Dan's picked some belters, to be fair, but I realised when I was trying to think through it, and I didn't realise, I knew I liked maroon, but I must also like purple as well, because I was thinking, like, the mid-90s Tony Colton purple and green goalie kit, like, that was a belter. It has lovely cushion pads when you're diving on concrete as a kid.
It did.
And I like, obviously, the purple and white one. The maroon and navy and white Kappa one that Dan mentioned, but also the maroon and white Umbro one from the year before. And Grace bought me a replica of that last Christmas. So I love that one. But I also like the Reebok white one with the purple shoulders.
That's an odd choice.
Yeah.
I think of Sean Wright Phillips in that one.
Yeah, well, I had Wright Phillips 29 on the back, and when we sold him, the 29 fell off in the wash, but the Wright Phillips stayed on. So I used to play PE in it and say it was Bradley Wright Phillips.
Excellent stuff. There's a purpley maroon one that was the third kit in the Keegan in the final season at Main Road. They won at West Brom in it. Was like I still see one or two of them around in like charity shops and stuff. That I'm just like, if I see one of them in my size, I'm getting it, no matter how much it costs. That like, I genuinely regret not getting that at the time.
Yeah, I agree. But yeah, I didn't realise I had such a penchant for purple and maroon. But my number one all time kit is it 2008, 2009 Umbro kit? Is it that one that had that really nice like kind of cotton feel to it?
9-10, I think.
Was it 9-10? Yeah.
Yeah. 08-09 was Lecoq Sportif messing up the orange third kit. And...
It's the one after it, the lovely Umbro one with the nice feel. That's my undisputed favourite kit.
Yeah. Any that you regret not getting, Dan?
Well, mine is one from that season as well, the one with the red and black sash, the white one. I really love that one. And I also like that one that we had on the Sven season we won at West Ham in, the blue one with a blue sash. Yeah,
yeah, that was a lovely kit. The ones that I regret not getting are the... I've never had a black and red kit.
Really?
Actually, now that I've just thought of it, no, I had the black and red one from like the Anelka era, but it was way too big for me, I've just thought. But that wasn't one of the best ones. We've had a lot better black and red ones, but I've never had one of those, no.
Yeah, the Dzeko at Spurs one is the one I think of.
Yeah, that's a really good kit, yeah. That's from that same season, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, that's the... that was the title-winning season, wasn't it? It was the year after the...
All the Mancini years just clearly blend into one for me.
Yeah, because they finished Mancini's era with that wonderful maroon away kit that they won at again West Brom in.
I've also got that one. That one's a belter. So I think pretty much every kit I've bought has got purple in it. I've just realised. Yeah,
excellent. Right. Well, we can put it off no longer, chaps. We're gonna have to get to that game that happened on Sunday. I mean, Dan, confidence, injuries, fatigue, no athleticism in the middle, aging legs, all of that we knew about beforehand, but did this result cross a line?
For me, it did actually, yeah. I mean, I'm sort of getting over it as the week goes on, and I'm well aware of the problems that City have got this season. I'm kind of okay with the way things have gone, you know, especially after what they've done in recent years. I was expecting a drop-off at some point. I wasn't quite expecting it to be this severe, to be fair, but, you know, it's understandable the way things have panned out, you know, since Rodri's injury, since everything's fell apart. But this was a performance where I just felt let down by it, really. You know, losing a game, you can sort of handle losing games. We've lost lots of games in our lifetime and to United as well, you know, it happens.
We've lost lots of games over the last couple of weeks, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. But I think from the position that City were in, and they played shit on the day, let's be honest, it was a terrible performance. I think if they'd won the game, it would have been a little bit unjust, and I think a draw probably would have been a fair result. And therefore, when United equalised, it was a bit like, all right, it's fine, you know, we've drawn the game, never mind. Just don't lose the game from here. Come on, like, show a bit of professionalism. Hang in there.
Did you not immediately just know once they got one they were going to get two, though?
Yeah, completely.
I think that was why it crossed the line for me. It was just... You just could see it coming. They just wilted like spinach. It was just, they just completely fell apart and they were shite all game, like you say, but, oh, God, it did me head in.
Is it worse, KC, because, again, like, City were bad, United were bad, both teams were terrible, and United haven't had to earn that victory in the end. City were in a position where United had to earn it and they didn't.
It's like I'm tempted to just say, like, you know, my full analysis is just one word: shit. Like, I just didn't enjoy any of it. I even missed our goal going to the loo when I was at the ground. So yeah, I just did not get any enjoyment whatsoever out of Sunday. I know obviously people tune in for like analysis of the game and stuff like that, but for me it was just more a game about just like the feeling afterwards and stuff like that. You're just like, what the fuck is going on? Like Dan said, I was relatively fine with most of the stuff, you know, so far, because, you know, there's mitigating circumstances. But to just play like that in a derby, you just think, what the fuck? Like even when we were 1-0 up, we were just shit. It was just, everything was just terrible. Like the whole of Sunday was terrible. I don't really know what to add apart from shit.
Excellent, right? Well, the thing is, though, Dan.
Great podcast, guys.
Yeah, we'll call it that. The thing is, though, Dan. Like we know we've talked about the issues endlessly, and we're not going to go through them again because there's literally no point. But like they're 1-0 up with a corner. It kind of sums up where they are mentally at the minute, that corner ends up with a few passes square on the halfway line. And I know Matias Nunes has made a short back pass and, you know, Edison has come out and almost rescued the situation by forcing him wide, and then Nunes has compounded the error by giving the penalty away. But like that's a situation that shouldn't happen because City should just be a lot better at keeping the ball in a much more dangerous area, shouldn't they? And like when you consider that that's what's happened for the equaliser, you don't let one single ball over the top for the winner then cause you the same sort of problems, do you?
No, that's what I mean. You know, that goal happens. You know, it's a bad mistake. And I felt really sorry for Nunes because I thought he'd had a good game on the day. Arguably our best player on the day, which isn't saying an awful lot, I know, because everyone was quite poor. And he's a square peg in a round hole playing at fullback. And I thought he did all right and you know, put an effort in. And I'm sure he was absolutely gutted to give that goal away, give that penalty away.
He was in tears on the pitch afterwards. It's kind of like, it's in many ways, I feel sorry for him because it's not really his fault that he's been put in that situation.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of when he got picked there, I'd said on the podcast earlier in the season that I think he's going to be our sort of utility man. You know, that's his best chance of getting games this year. So I thought, oh, here we go, here's our new Fabian Delph, Zinchenko type player. You know, and he did all right, but there's just a lack of confidence all over the pitch at the moment, isn't there? You know, it goes from the goalkeeper right up to Haaland. You know, we're not seeing enough goals coming from other areas of the pitch. You know, Grealish hasn't scored for a year now or something. It's like 30 hours of football without a goal for Grealish, which is just really poor, I'm afraid. You know, Foden doesn't look himself. De Bruyne had a shocking game. Bernardo's knackered. Gundogan's knackered. You know, the defence is what it is. It's been chopping and changing. There's been no settled back four at all. And it just, I think the tactics on Sunday, while they perhaps meant that City didn't become sort of overrun too much in the game, there seemed to be a lot of indecisiveness and a lot of unsureness on the pitch as to what people were supposed to be doing. Are we pressing here? Are we doing this? I don't know. It just seemed very, very disjointed all day. Yeah. And when we're 1-0 up, the game's drifting through and you're thinking, all right, 1-0, we've won this game. It's nice to have a bit of a break from the spiral of defeats. Nice to have a break from all this talking about the problems and the crisis. It wouldn't have changed an awful lot, really. I wouldn't have felt any more confident going into Saturday's game against Villa had we won that game than if we've lost it, because I don't think it really changes much. But the loss really does feel like another hammer blow to me, really, and another disappointment. And I just don't see when this bad form is going to end anytime soon, really. I think it's going to be this. We're going to be like this all season, aren't we? Really?
Yeah, it's got to be January now, hasn't it? And new players, basically. And they need more athleticism in the centre of the pitch. I mean, KC, you said you felt as soon as United equalised that you could feel the winner coming. Like, if you can feel that, and everybody else in the stadium can feel that, the players can surely feel that. So why not in that situation? I mean, it's a ball over the top where I think it's Diaz who hasn't tracked the run, and then Edison's kind of come and stopped, and it's just kind of like those moments of indecision. If somebody just takes control of it, then it doesn't happen.
Guardiola as well, by the way. You've got to stop that on the line, man. Come on. I didn't get that at all. What are you doing?
Yeah. But it's like, even obviously, you know, the run of form that we're on now and stuff like that, but we were kind of like that against them in the FA Cup final, weren't we?
The opening goal,
just I don't know why, because you think we are so much better on paper than United, and then the last couple of games we've just been so poor against them. It's ridiculous. We're making them look like a competent team, which they are absolutely not.
Neither are we at the minute, though.
I know. It's just it's just very frustrating. Because you do think the last couple of transfer windows haven't been the best, have they? You know, in terms of the players that we've brought in, I think a lot of people could see that we've had aging legs in midfield, and that has come back to bite us this year. But even with that, that kind of performance was just nowhere near good enough. In terms of sort of like basic effort, and I know the players are really tired, but they just didn't see it. Like, I know they're low on confidence, but you just think for a derby, just have some passion. And there wasn't any passion in the game, was there? It was just very sterile, and I could see why you'd go for that. But I just think that was the wrong kind of time to be doing it. I think we should have just tried to overrun them or do something. But there was just, they just didn't seem to be... We seemed to be afraid of winning that game, which, you know, you'd never really say under Guardiola before, would you?
Yeah, it's funny because we think back to that, certainly like that first season of Guardiola's and the 1920 season where things didn't quite go to plan. I mean, I'd kill for a season like that right now. It's funny, isn't it? Yeah. Dan, we were talking before the show to kind of work out how to do this because we obviously don't want to dwell too much on the game and focus again on the same old talking points from the same old problems that City have got all season. And you said to me it reminded you of that Blackburn game back in 2007 where the fans really turned on the players that day when they were singing "You're not fit to wear the shirt." They got out of the FA Cup to a 10-man Blackburn team. Like, where does this sort of performance at the moment rank to those sorts of days? Because, like, when you said this one felt like it crossed the line. City have obviously... It obviously feels like City have let you down here. But, like, how much is it? In the context of what they've achieved in the last 4 years or so, like, how bad can it get? How bad do you feel about it?
Yeah, I mean, I might have been a bit emotional when I said that on Sunday about the Blackburn game. Drinks had been drunk, let's put it that way. But you know, my mind just went back to it because I was kind of thinking, like, you know, we know the problems that City have got. We know what they've done in the past. I have full respect for this team and I back Guardiola completely to turn it around eventually, get them out of it. You know, they're allowed a year off. They're allowed a bad season. They're allowed a few bad performances, a run of shocking results, really. I'll allow them all that. But when it's a derby, it feels a bit different, doesn't it? It feels like, come on, you just hang in there for us, you know, because we've got to put up with, you know, we all know United fans. I consider some of them friends even, you know, against my better judgment, you know, and we've got this whole week at least afterwards of piss taking after a result like that, you know, and a little bit unjustly really, because United are in terrible form at the moment as well. But we also all remember what it was like to get a win over them back in the day and how we'd lord it over them. So that was my feelings after the game. It's like, you've let us down against our biggest rivals here. You know, you could have just hung on for a 1-1 draw there, been a bit sensible, been a bit professional, and it's all right, you know, we can accept that. When you throw a game away like that, it feels a bit unacceptable. I won't say unforgivable. I've seen that word knocking about, you know, a lot this week. And I forgave them within half an hour of the final whistle because, yeah, you know, agree, shit happens. Yeah. It's football, innit? But I just want to see...
It's Homer Simpson, isn't it? I can't stay mad at you to that sandwich where it, like, keeps giving him food poisoning.
Yeah. And the difference between sort of this team and the team that were not fit to wear the shirt back in the day under Stuart Pearce was that they didn't give a fuck, those players, did they, back in the day, really? They couldn't care less. Whereas I know that this lot are hurting. I know that they're desperate to put it right, almost to a fault at the moment. I think they're in their own heads a little bit too much about, we need to turn this around as quickly as possible. And I think... You know,
that's probably why Nunes gives the penalty away, because he's trying too hard to make up for his mistake.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then when they can see the equaliser, the first thought is, come on, we've got to get a winner now. And that's where the second goal comes from. And it's like, just calm down. A draw, we'll take a draw from this now. It's been a bad day. We'll get out of it with a point apiece, shake hands on that. And I think they just threw it away because they were a bit too eager to try and get the winner, really.
But you know, like, it's funny that you mentioned the Blackburn game. Like, the big difference that I've seen is obviously on the Blackburn game that you mentioned, there was a lot of blue on blue, wasn't there? you know, scrapping and stuff like that. But, like, on Sunday, I've never been at a game where I've seen as many half and half scarves, which is just unacceptable at a derby. Like, it was really weird. The atmosphere even before kickoff was really weird. The concourse was way more full than it normally is before games as well, because normally it's fairly quiet, you know, with people either getting in late, you know, from wherever. But it seemed that everyone got to the ground early, which normally would be conducive to, you know, everyone up for this kind of atmosphere. But it was so low, like, not low as in, like, you know, we're really poor. There just seemed to be loads of people around and about the place that were there just for the tourism. And it was a really strange atmosphere. I don't know what the club were doing with tickets, but there seemed to be lots and lots and lots of tourists, considering that I've not seen that kind of level at a derby. There was loads and loads of half and half scar. And I've got nothing against you know tourists or people coming in for games and stuff like that, but don't be wearing a half and half scarf at the derby. And if you're at least there, at least, you know, make some noise and stuff like that.
That's to be balanced, doesn't it? Yeah,
there was people just like videoing on the phones, you know, people not even really watching the game, you know, in and out of the seats constantly. It was really, really strange considering it was a derby.
Get your ears around our bonus episodes every Monday. Patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
While we're piling on the misery, gents, just wondering any other times that City have really let you down? Because I always think it comes down to expectations versus reality, because there's the whole idea that kind of you look at where City are now and you go, well, at least they're not playing York, that sort of attitude. But at the same time, the expectations at the start of that season against York were not to win the title, whereas this season they were. So, like, have there been any times where you've looked at it and gone, you know what, I've really let down by you at this moment in time? That isn't obviously down that Blackburn game.
Honestly, I'm struggling to think of any, really. I mean, when the relegations were sort of going on, I was maybe a little too young to kind of appreciate the gravitas of the situation, really. And then we had that sort of period where it was on the up and up. You know, the relegation from the Premier League under Joe Royal, I think, wasn't hugely disappointing in the end, because it just...
I cried at that one. I was bawling my eyes out at that, yeah.
Yeah. But I don't know, I didn't feel let down by them that season necessarily.
No.
The Liverpool one was the one I cried at most, the Ian Rush 2-2 game or whatever.
Yeah.
But again, Dan, I think I was a bit too, I didn't understand, I just was really upset because it was City, but I don't think I understood the gravitas of the situation, same as you. Blackburn probably is the zenith, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember, you know, when we went down at Stoke, the 5-2 that we won, I remember not being bothered by that, because me and my mate who I was watching it with went outside to play cricket immediately. So I knew I didn't get the gravitas of that one.
Actually, I know what the answer is here. It's when we went out of the fucking Champions League to Lyon the other year.
Pathetic,
wasn't it? So that's like you say, it's about expectations versus reality, right? So, you know, we were expected to beat Lyon that time, you know, and we were really poor. And there was a few games like that in the Pellegrini era as well, I think, where it's just like, we should be doing a lot better than this. You know, we've got a good team here and we're not playing well at all, you know.
The Leicester defeat when they won the league, yeah.
Yeah, or that Burnley away one, I remember being horrific. Like, that was really... disappointed as well. So
I remember being fuming after a 0-0 draw against Birmingham at home under Mancini as well. I don't know why that game sticks out.
That was on my birthday, and I remember exactly, because he took Carlos, like they were drawing 0-0 with about 10 minutes left. He took Tevez off and brought Gareth Barry on, and the entire stadium was going, what on earth are you doing?
I used to sit behind the managers at that point in time, and God, I was screaming at them. Screaming at him with that substitution.
Yeah.
But that felt a really bad game, because that Birmingham side under McLeish was shite as well.
Yeah.
Another one that springs to mind, actually, is that one where we should have beaten United to win the league, which was like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to do that. We're 2-0 up at half-time, basically celebrating the league title at half-time, and somehow lost 3-2. I came out of that ground thinking, I am never going to get over this. Luckily, I did get over it. But.
Yeah. I was going to say, I hope the week later you were feeling a lot better about it, because that was KC's birthday party.
yeah, it was. Well, we got absolutely... Well, I think that United one, though, Dan, I think everybody I knew just went out and got absolutely trolleyed that night anyway to just forget about it.
Yeah.
I think I got in at like 5 a.m. after being at a Chinese karaoke bar in Chinatown.
Excellent. Good stuff. Right, so we're going to stick with the nostalgia for old times right now. We're going to go back to a period in City's history where things were much worse than any of the recent form at the moment. In the late 90s, as City slid down the leagues, there was often only one reason for going to Main Road, as Georgie Kincladze proved to be a beacon of light during the dark times. He's been in Manchester this week to launch his new Georgian Wine project, and I caught up with him to get his memories of playing at City, starting with when he joined in 1995.
We have a game against Wales. Georgian international team. We played home game in Georgia, away game in Wales, and a chief scout was from City, and from that game, they bought me, Francis Lee.
Did you speak a lot with Francis Lee at that time?
At that time, I don't speak very much good English, but yeah. He really looked after me. He was very, very good man.
What was the feeling around the move to City? Because obviously it's a move to the Premier League. Did you know much about City at the time?
Know about the City, but in Georgia we watch the Premier League, so all the football players dream to play in Premier League. Doesn't matter which team, to play Premier League. So I was lucky. Game here, dream come true.
How were you feeling about it when you arrived in England?
From beginning was because I was 21 years old, no speak English, nothing, but they like have such a welcome. I feel like it's my second home here, so I didn't feel I'm a like foreigner or something. You know, they treat me very well, always until this day. 30 years is gone, and I have same feeling when I'm coming here.
What was it like? You said obviously you didn't speak a lot of English at the time. Yeah. Did that make it hard to settle?
From beginning, yes, but in the field you don't need to speak English, so just give me the ball and that's it. Nothing else. To be fair, 90s when I signed here, there's not many foreign players here. And three players can play foreign in the team. So it was really difficult. It was from beginning, of course, difficult, but they like bring me like welcome to help me, teammates. Everybody was behind my back, so it was after 3-4 months, so it was great, easy.
What was it like in the early days at City? Because as much as Alan Ball was kind of building the team around you, The team wasn't picking up points. There were the start to that season was very bad.
Was first 9 games we just had 1 point. That's the problem. That's why I think we relegated. Even this from 9 games, even we have 3 points there, we will be all right. But you know, was new players in the team. All new players before we settled down. All the players, it took time and shame. He's coming everything like when I pass the people, he's coming from the game moments. I'd never plan this to pass the 1 or 3 players and chip the goalkeeper. It's just the moments in the game. For me, still, Premier League, one of the best leagues in the world.
I have to ask you about the Southampton goal. Yeah. Because that was, I mean, somehow didn't win goal of the season that season, came second in goal of the season. Yeah. But as that's happening, as you're running through on goal, do you know how good it is what you're doing?
No, I mean, when I pass the player, 1, 2, or the crowd, you know, when they shout and goes, and when I go to put my head in the goalkeeper, I see goalkeeper and check the goalkeeper. It was a good goal, great goal.
when you faced the goalkeeper, did you know what you were going to do? Or did you? Because you sat him down first.
Yeah, I sat him down, yeah, of course.
When you think of kind of those moments and kind of the skills that you had in those sorts of games, there's videos of you on YouTube kind of going one way, going the other way, going one way, the other way, and defenders just not able to get near you. What were you thinking as you were doing that? How did you manage to do that to opposition players?
I'm thinking now when I watch the games, after 30 years, I was good. I was good. In Georgia, we have before our generation, also very skillful players. We play always in Georgia attacking football, pretty football, and too many skillful players.
Do you remember your first goal?
In
for City?
Yeah, Aston Villa. 91st minute, I think, was 0-0. We scored the goal, we won the game, yeah.
Back heel from Niall Quinn.
Great guy, great player, yeah. In Premier League, when you play, you always remember first game and you always remember first goal.
You mentioned the relegation at the end of that season. How did you feel coming off the pitch against Liverpool?
I don't remember. It's just very, very sad. Very sad. Especially for our City fans. You know, this is first time you relegated and it was so much clapping in the stadium. You know, it was just horrible feeling was there.
What was Main Road like to play in?
To be fair, when I go to the Etihad, and I remember Main Road, I don't know why, but atmosphere was in Main Road was better. I don't know why. Maybe not winning the games too easy. That's why, you know, they know they win, and they don't shout much.
You talked before about having other Georgian players at City at the time. Did that have anything to do with you, the reason that they were there? Were you kind of like suggesting, I know this player?
No, I mean, they asking me, Francis Lee, well, what do you think about this player, Kavelashvili, which became president of Georgia now? They asked me about the defenders, and I just say, yeah, they're good players, they will help us. And they brought him.
When you think of the start of the next season, Alan Ball resigns, there's several managers in a couple of months. What was that like to try and play in? That must have been difficult.
It was very difficult, because it doesn't matter how good you are, player, when you're changing four or five managers in the two seasons, it's always difficult. Because every manager is coming, they have their view, tactic, football player, so they make new players, so it's always difficult. Yeah.
You scored a free kick against QPR, which I think gets forgotten. Yeah, gets forgotten about because of Jamie Pollock's own goal.
Because this time, this is like when you see you want to relegate it. You know, these teams always, these games always going wrong. Your own goal, or maybe you miss very good chances. And this was the time to just want to go down, and after we'll go up.
Did you get the sense at the end of that, the feeling at the end of that season, that no matter how hard you tried,
it was just out of control?
Yeah, it was.
Because that time I have too many proposals from another team, so my head was a little bit, you know, was like a football player. Everybody was like, you know.
Did you feel the pressure? Because if the rest of the team isn't performing, it's kind of on you to do something.
I never feel pressure. It's nothing too easy in football, you know, if you don't have... No, never feel I have pressure. No. Otherwise, everything will be easy, you know.
How did you end up moving away from City? Was that your decision, or was that Joe's decision?
No, there was they need money to bring new players, and they sold me the 4.5, I think, to Ajax or something like that. And they bring eight or nine new players. Save the team. Save the.
How was it? Well, because you moved to Derby a bit later in your career.
From Ajax, yeah.
Yeah, and you came back to Main Road as a Derby player. What was that like as an away player?
I respect all the clubs I went after City, but my head was there, but my heart was always here. Just unbelievable.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
That was Georgie Kinkladze speaking to me. I mean, when you think back, Dan, to that era of City and the Kappa kits, like, I know Kinkladze had only one season in that, but it was kind of like, it just kind of summed up where City were at the time. They had this great kit, this great player, and just could not get the best out of him at all.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't a Joe Royal player, was he? I think Joe Royal pretty much jettisoned him from the team as soon as he came in, rightly or wrongly. I mean, Kinkladze's shining moment for City, or shining season, was that year in the Premier League where we got relegated. I think when we went down to the lower leagues, he struggled quite a bit, actually. You know, he was getting kicked a lot, he was getting targeted by opposition players, and it was difficult for him, I think. And yeah, when he left the club, you sort of thought he'd go on to bigger and better things, and he didn't really either. So you do kind of think of it in terms of like that year that he had in the Premier League, and wonder, you know, in a better team, would he have flourished a bit more? We'll never know, will we, really? But he was, you know, he was fantastic to watch that year, a real, you know, memorable player to watch in a relegation year. But it's a shame that the way that his career and City's kind of went down the pan after that.
Yeah, KC, were you? You said about the heartbreak at the end of that season with the Liverpool game. Were you in Ireland at this point? Were you going to any games?
No,
you here?
No, I was here, but I didn't. I wasn't going to games then. I think it was 6 or 7.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it was before I moved to Ireland, like a year or two later.
Yeah, I just wondered if you were there for that, because I was there for the Southampton goal. I just don't really remember it.
No, I wasn't. No, I think I've talked about it before. I think the Liverpool 2-2 game was in the Huntingdon pub in Longsight, bawling my eyes out. Or it might have been called the Mad Hatter then. I think it's called Howdy's, and it's a cowboy restaurant.
Oh, yeah.
Um, It looks awful, by the way. So you might not be getting sponsorship off them after I've said that. But yeah, I was in the Huntingdon pub as a kid. You know, with me bottle of Britvic 55 and a packet of crisps. And yeah, I just remember just bawling my eyes out, just being so upset that we went down.
Yeah. But I mean, in terms of watching City at that time then, if you'd not been able to get to many games and not been able to see much of it, did you really have a handle on how good Kinclancy had been for City?
Oh yeah, and again, looking back, it's really, because I think me and my mates that were City fans, we were just so obsessed with Kinclancy. Because and it's really strange now, because I remember, like, it's only when you're older you realise why your mum was telling you not to do it. But you know, like computer games back then, you used to be able to put your name in and you're only allowed a maximum of 6 characters. My name on everything was Kinky, like on absolutely everything. But it's only,
your online presence was Kinky.
Yeah,
still is.
But yeah, it's just, yeah, everybody was obsessed with him, and it was like, because obviously I wasn't going to games, but it was like any footage you could get of him whatsoever was just like gold dust. So like, you know, like on season reviews, VHSs and stuff like that, you just watched his stuff over and over and over again.
Yeah. Got a nice little piece of trivia about, you know, the West Ham FA Cup goal, Dan?
Yep.
That was the last time a goal from outside the Premier League won the BBC's Goal of the Month competition.
Really?
Yeah, because back then they used to include FA Cup goals from games that they had screened live, and they'd screen that game live, and that won Goal of the Month.
Fair play. Hell of a game. Hell of a post sound as well, wasn't it?
It is, yeah. It's a cracking. Yes. It doesn't make sense that the post makes that noise, but you know, here we are. Right, so let's have a look ahead to the games that City have got coming up. We'll start by finding out how Villa are going to take the 3 points at the weekend. I've been speaking to Frankie Maguire from All Villa, No Filler.
It's a funny one. I think Aston Villa's current sort of inconsistent form is reflective of what the Premier League itself is a bit like at the moment. Feels like a little like looking at the you know, the Championship, where, you know, 2 wins and you're suddenly flying a bit higher than you actually thought you were, and then 2 losses and you're straight back down to 11th. You know, it's a very, very weird league this year, and I think Aston Villa reflect that. I think started the season well, and then it all started sort of, I think it was the start of November. We were all over Bournemouth for about 78 minutes. We scored, then Bournemouth were all over us for 10 minutes and conceded a goal in the last second of the game to draw 1-1. And from there, that's where Villa's form got very, very patchy. And I dare say it's probably similar to various other Champions League clubs where, it's weird for me to say that Aston Villa, a Champions League club, still feels weird to say that. But I think genuinely the game volume since early October has been very, very intense. And I think for Aston Villa, it's not something we're used to. It's something we have to get used to. And I think in time, hopefully, this is the start of a successful journey under Unai Emery. But at the moment, I feel like we're just getting caught by it. It's not a coincidence that our form after Champions League midweek games is generally not very good at all. And I think we're just suffering from that partly.
Yeah, well, just taking it away from this game at the weekend to start with, the Champions League. You're probably going to finish above City. You need a point to finish above City in that Champions League table. I don't see where City are actually going to. I'm genuinely worried City won't even qualify for the next phase of this Champions League. How's that been this season for you?
Oh, it's been an absolutely incredible experience. You know, our first Champions League game at home was against Bayern Munich, and I was fortunate enough to get tickets to it. And I think, you know, in 33-ish years of supporting Aston Villa, it's the greatest moment I've ever had at Villa Park, to be honest. And, you know, there's been some really good moments. It's all quite relative. I've not seen my team do a Sergio Aguero last-minute winner or anything like that. But, you know, there's been good moments. But that was just, you know, you look at football and Bayern Munich and Real Madrid, you know, within Europe, they're probably the two with Barcelona that you look at and think, they're kind of like, you know, if it was a computer game, they're the final boss. And to, you know, play as well as we did, to score, you know, to score a late, you know, class goal through John Duran, and then that outpouring of noise you had when the final whistle went, you know, just the whole feeling of it. I guess it's the same when Man City were in the Champions League. I don't know whether you've, you know, whether you're so used to it now, but, you know, for our first experience, to see kind of the blue lighting around the stadium in the Champions League, to see all the photographers there, the smoke across the pitch, the banners going up, just the theme at the start as well. The whole thing, it was quite cinematic, really. And one of the few times I think I've ever openly kind of wept in a stadium. Mm. So it was just an incredible experience. And I think, you know, we've got maybe a little bit luckier with the draw than a few other teams have. But at the same time, you can only beat what's in front of you. And, you know, we've beaten Bayern Munich, but then, you know, we've beaten the like Bologna, Young Boys, and Leipzig as well. So, yeah, it's been an incredible experience. And weirdly, we look almost better in the Champions League than we do in the Premier League.
Yeah, I was going to, like, in terms of form for the weekend, I mentioned those three wins. Obviously, beat Brentford and Southampton at Villa Park and then Leipzig. Lost at Forest this week. Like, how's that happening? Is there just a struggle for consistency at the moment?
There is, yeah. So one of the big problems for Aston Villa this season is we can see goals constantly. We've had two clean sheets this season. I think in both of those games, we looked like we should have conceded. It feels a little bit like I think some teams have worked out how to press Villa. I went to Chelsea away recently. They beat us 3-0. And they were excellent. You know, they're in real hot form. But at the same time, that was quite a worry to me, where it looked like we were really struggling to play out in a way that we haven't really done. And I felt it a little bit this season that teams, you know, if you're a top team, you press hard against Villa. And if you're a team, you know, like Crystal Palace a few weeks ago, who were down the bottom end, just pick your moments when to hit them on the break. And it feels like at the moment we haven't got a way of dealing with either approach. And there will just be a moment in the first 20 minutes where one of our defenders, probably Diego Carlos, will pass a ball straight into the opposition midfield when we try and retain it at the back. And it will be a big chance. And I think that's partly why we're conceding so many goals. And a lot of the goals we conceded are really, really stupid basic errors, but it's possibly
you saw the game City played this week.
yeah I did so it could be quite entertaining for the neutral City Villa this weekend if they keep conceding stupid goals all the time. But yeah, it's fundamentally, I think it's teams just pressuring us into giving the ball away, and we keep doing it. And just not finding consistency. And you know, at times we control games really, really well, but then once we go ahead, the opposition team just goes, right, throw the game plan out and we go for it. And Villa just do not react. We always carry on playing as if nothing's changed. It's still the first 70 minutes and they haven't thrown two subs on to go at us and go at us with speed. So I think at the moment we're in a bit of a learning phase, and I'm not sure our defence is quite capable of playing the way Unai Emery wants at the moment.
Yeah, in terms of, I'm interested kind of how you view this fixture compared to last season, because going into the one last season, I think it was probably fair to say that you sensed you could get something from City, because City were not in a good place at that time as well, been struggling a bit with performances. Obviously, Rodri was out for that one as well, and Villa certainly took the moment and were one of the best, putting one of the best performances I've ever seen against this City team. When you compare it to this year, given where Villa are and kind of like when you look from the outside, the problems that City have right now as well, do you get the same sort of feeling?
It's interesting. So this time last year, I still saw City as the invincible team that always, even when City were, you know, not doing too well and playing the likes of Gillingham, City would find a way to just beat Villa. They just were a team that we just didn't have fun against ever. And then obviously, you know, since the last sort of 12 to 15 years, you've been, you know, an incredible football team. I still thought in my head, I thought, I just can't see us doing it. So when we did, it was just absolutely extraordinary. Whereas this year, there's still that lingering sense in my head of, you know, City are City at the end of the day, and Villa can still be Villa, and we still shoot ourselves in the foot where, you know, Villa give the ball away in their own third to a Foden or a Haaland or whoever, we are going to get punished.
They can cross it and Haaland can head it over.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I mean, the chances are we will be punished for that. But, you know, ultimately, I think Villa probably have to approach like we did the Bayern game, where, you know, if we have to cede some possession, then fine. But, you know, everybody just concentrating for 90 minutes and not giving away stupid passes to the opposition. But yeah, it's funny. I mean, part of me does think like there's something fundamentally seems quite wrong at City at the moment. Whether it's just it's become a missing a couple of players and become a confidence issue that's therefore making things worse. And it feels like everything's going against, when the players are on the pitch, it feels like everything's going against them. But then again, you know, you've also had a similar thing to Villa where you've been playing games back to back, and it's hard to adjust when you do need to adjust. And so now you've got a week, you know, a full week off. Maybe that'll help City help you, you know, come up with a new game plan that might just catch Villa out. But I'm probably more confident than I have been ever. Mm. But at the same time, I don't want to be too confident.
Yeah, no, I understand that entirely. Obviously, a win this weekend would put you above City in the table. What's the aim for this season? Because obviously you're balancing playing in the Champions League with, I guess, attempting to get back into the Champions League next season.
Yes. So, I mean, now I've had the Champions League once, I'm a bit addicted to it and I never want to not have it again. Obviously, I know that's an unrealistic prospect, but I think European football has to be the aim for Villa this season again. I mean, the fact we're still in sixth to seventh, I think, and so close to the top four, given that we've been this inconsistent, we've kind of gotten away with it a little bit, really. So if we can just get a run of form together, then, you know, like a 4 or 5 game winning streak or something, then it gives us a real good chance of getting Champions League again. And on top of that, fifth place this season is probably going to be Champions League with the coefficient.
Yeah.
Last year I was the chairman of Coefficient FC, as I called it. I handed in my resignation when we got top four. Now I'm proudly wearing my half and half Coefficient FC and Aston Villa scarf. I think ultimately European football has to be the aim, whether that's Conference League again or Europa League. I think we just need to get a run of seasons in Europe, and because then we become identified as a team that does that regularly. And with Unai Emery, you never know what we could potentially win, say, like a Europa League or Conference League or something like that.
Yeah, definitely. Who's going to do the damage this weekend? If Villa are to win the game, who will be your players that do it?
I've got a funny feeling John Duran. He's in red-hot form. He's not as, I think when you watch a game, he's probably similar to Haaland in the sense he can probably go 85 minutes where it feels like you haven't seen him, but then he pops up with an incredible goal of some type and you look at him and go, this kid could be one of the best strikers in world football. He really could. And I think he's had a couple of really big moments for Villa already. I think he's waiting for a game where he scores 2 or 3 in the Premier League in one game against big opposition. And everybody wakes up then and goes, bloody hell, this guy's really, really special. Whether that's this weekend, I don't know. So I'd say Duran, but I think you've got to look at Morgan Rodgers as well. There's some games where he gets, former City boy, some games where he gets space. If he can find space between the defence and the City midfielders, he can cause absolute havoc as well.
That's good to hear, because there's absolute acres of it at the moment. So sounds like he'll have a good afternoon.
Yeah, I think, him and if Jacob Ramsey were fit, again, he's a top player who can really exploit that sort of space. And then behind that, Boubacar Kamara's returned, and he's been a fantastic addition back to us. And actually, I saw this week someone say that Kamara would be a good replacement for Rodri at City. And I was like, I hadn't even thought about that. And I think, do you know what? I'd recommend watching Kamara this weekend. And if he has a good game, thinking of that comparison and thinking, actually, yeah, I can see that. He's not Rodri's level. I think Rodri is the best player in the world. I genuinely do. I think he's incredible. But Kamara is certainly a player that I think could really help a side like City. He's a really, really top player.
Yeah. Frankie, we've got the charity bet coming up. This one feels like an absolute fool's errand given the form of the teams at the moment, but that's why I'm giving my bet over to you. What are you having for this one?
I've gone with two teams that simply will not stop conceding goals. So I'm going to say 2-2. I think that City, you just can't continue losing. And I think
we can.
I could see 3-2 maybe to Villa, but I'm going to go with 2-2 this weekend.
Email the show through our website, bluemoonpodcast.com.
That was Frankie from All Villa, No Filler. Kieran, Villa have won 3 of the last 4, which means that it feels like they're in good form. But at the same time, they've only won 3 of the last 12. How are you feeling about this one?
In all honesty, I've been trying not to think about it. It's only because of this podcast that I have actually thought about it. And, you know, you do want to keep up a positive outlook and think, actually, maybe that game on Sunday is you know, is going to be a turning point, and you think, right, that's going to, that this one is actually going to be the kick up the arse that they need to actually turn it round. But I don't have a lot of faith in that positive thinking of myself, because I'm just a natural miserable bastard.
I didn't want to say it, but I'm glad you've said it. Yeah.
If you offered me a draw now, I'd take it. Like that. Yeah. That's the way I see the game. And if it's a score draw, that would be very positive. If we got a couple of goals, maybe. If we get a win on the weekend, I feel like it might be a bit of a robbery if we do. Yeah. One of those kind of games. I've not really got that much faith that we're gonna turn up and play to the best of our abilities.
Yeah, because I just thinking about it, Dan, Villa are slightly out of form this season. They've not been as good as they have in previous years. But obviously City are nowhere near the standard that they normally are as well.
Yeah, they've been quite crap, haven't they, Villa? I think with City, you know, on our good day, I expect us to beat anyone, really. You know, you think we'll take on anyone in the world and beat them. At the moment, and when certainly not in our good day, I'm thinking anyone could beat us, you know? And Villa will probably look at this game as a bit of an opportunity to get their season back on track. I think they'll be licking their lips a little bit. I don't know how you can really go into this game with any confidence as a City fan at the moment, because we just don't know what team's going to turn up. We don't know what the performance is going to be like. We don't know what the tactics are going to be like. We don't know who's going to play, what the personnel is going to be like, really, you know, what the back four is going to look like. It's just really tricky.
Does the full week off change that, or is the crisis now beyond just getting a few players some rest?
I hope so. I mean, it's like I said about the United game. I think they need to just chill out a little bit now. Like, the first step towards reparation and sort of fixing the problems is accepting that we've got problems that aren't going to be fixed very quickly, and just, you know, that the season's a little bit of a write-off now, and we can regroup after Christmas. We've still hopefully got the Champions League to compete for and the FA Cup. You know, I wouldn't really back us to win any of those at the moment, but, you know, the season's long and the league title's pretty much gone, I think. I'm fascinated to know what the reaction in the dressing room is like at the moment, what Pep is saying to them after games. You know, unfortunately, I don't think they're going to release a Together documentary at the end of the season, Ali, the way things are going, so we'll probably never know. But, like, you know, he'll have gone through his time at the club where we've had these setbacks, you know, and it'll have been one defeat here and there. We've played badly. He'll tear a strip off him. He'll know when to do that. He'll know when to put an arm around the shoulder kind of thing. Where are you at the moment? Is it arm around the shoulder all the time? Is he going mad at them after every game? Or is it just kind of silence in the dressing room? I'd love to know how they're actually reacting to these things. And I think this week off, it is just a bit of a chance to have a bit of a reset and say, look, we'll go into this game. We'll try our best. We might not win it. And then we've got a couple of winnable games coming up on paper. Maybe we can get a bit of form together heading into the new year, and we start again. We go in January. We try and buy some players. But yeah, I don't have much confidence about this game, to be honest, but we'll see.
Well, the thing about, like you know, you mentioned about Villa's form not being that great, but where they have had good results has been in the big games in the Champions League, and they'll see us as a Champions League game, and they'll be really up for it at their place.
Yeah,
I can see it being something, you know, like when they beat Bayern Munich or whatever earlier this year.
Yeah.
You can see the atmosphere being something similar, and it's just like you said, Dan. It's interesting about what the players are feeling at the moment, because how are they going to react to an atmosphere like that this weekend?
Maybe the
early kickoff will help us with that, you know, rather than it being later on in the day under the lights or whatever.
Yeah, keep everyone nice and serene. I hope everybody's still having a lie-in sort of thing. Given the way that Christmas falls this year, we're going to be previewing the game with Everton on this week's show too. So I've caught up with David Downey from the Blue Room podcast to find out how their season is going.
It's been the overwhelming issue here. It's since Sean Dyche has come in, it's become increasingly frustrating, because basically the way we play, we're just really, really awful to watch. You know, I know your guys will be having us around Christmas time, and it sort of feels like Scrooge will turn up, to be honest, when you're watching that game. The thing that's been overly frustrating is when he came in, he was the exact right man for the job. He come in, did what he could, kept us in the league, and then that should have been where we shook hands and parted ways. And I can understand, totally understand why he was given another year, because he's earned it, and, you know, rightly so. I say that with gritted teeth. But then, you know, there's a point, David, when you get to a stage, even when you're in a position we've been in for the past 4 years, where you're just fighting to stay in the Premier League, that you have to provide something more and do something more. And this season so far, Sean Dyche simply hasn't been able to do so. I think when outside looking in, Everton look relatively better. They look like they're in a more healthy position in Premier League table terms, in terms of there's no point deductions this season and whatnot. You get to that stage and you're like, well, okay, that is the foundation, particularly with the new stadium on the horizon as well. I think that's probably top of people's thoughts towards Everton, is just get to the new stadium in the Premier League and then we can sort of get a clean slate and go again. New owners thrown into there too. But with Dyche, I mean, we're more looking at him and Everton that, similar to last season, we're pretty much relying on there being three worse sides. Now, I'm pretty sure everybody would look towards us and say, do you know what, that's sort of inevitable. There'll be three worse sides than Everton. Like last season, I know Luton had a good go of it, but they ended up cocking up towards the end. And given we had a couple of points given back then, you know, we were still up with a couple of games to go, which is a luxury for us. Win against Liverpool, of course, as well. So he ended that season pretty well. This campaign, though, he's brought a couple of players in. So a real couple of strange ones as well. I mean, if you look at Jake O'Brien, who we've got on the bench, paid 15 million quid for him from Lyon. He hasn't played. He's been on the bench every week. I think off the pitch with Sean Dyche, there are some real deep-rooted issues, and they seem to not move and go away. And that's what's so frustrating to watch him. And then, of course, when you're seeing his in-game management, it's really turgid. It's so hard to watch. You're sitting on your seat there screaming, having to make a substitution. I remember, sadly, last year I was working out mathematically what stage of a game he got to before he made the substitution. He got to 74 before he made a substitution, regardless of games, whether you win, whether you're losing, whether you're drawing. That would be the time when he put any sort of change into his setup on the pitch, which shows that he's a man not for changing, and that's why he won't go manage a side that's above a relegation fighting concept every single season. And this campaign's been pretty much the same, to be honest.
I look at your performances though in the last few games, and a very good point at the Emirates in the last game. Obviously took Wolves apart, which is a thing that you know, City found it hard to beat Wolves at Molineux earlier this season. I mean, I know you were at Goodison for that one, and even the United game. I know you lost 4-0 in the end, but there was a lot of talk around that one that, you know, United were not very good for a good spell in that game, and Everton were the better team until United scored.
There was an emphasis on the first half hour, which I guess is the first thing Dyche is going to refer to after the game, which he inevitably did. And he was right. The first half hour, Everton probably should have gone 1-0 up. There's a few chances. We looked okay. There's good shape about the side. Midfield was dominating as well. You know, United, a sore subject for yourselves at the moment, I know, but United just still just look the same as Ten Hag to me personally when I've watched them play. There hasn't been any real changes, but obviously that's harsh towards a manager who's only been there a few weeks. You won't really see what he's implementing into it until, I don't know, the new year or whatever. But that first half hour was fine, and it's something you look at and think, well, where's this been when we've gone away from home? He goes with his solid back four. He has full back. He has sort of wingers fighting back to help out the full backs, and we've struggled there. Ashley Young's 39, and I'd say he's probably been our best player, which to many listening to this, they'll raise their eyebrows and think, well, what's going on with the rest of that side if you've got a 39-year-old right-back being the player of the season so far? But he's actually been really good, as well as being, you know, better than the others, because they're all worse, if you get what I mean. Similar side with Mikalenko as well. So he's used these wingers we've got, and Jack Harrison, who's forever slated. The issues against him are that he can't kick a ball or cross a ball properly, but he's great at tracking back. So I suppose that fits quite nicely into what Sean Dyche wants from this. But yeah, that half an hour, it was fine. We thought, you know, this is decent. This, you know, you turn them against each other. Their fans at Old Trafford, a bit sick of what they've been seeing. New manager, yes, but you know, there's still plenty of work to do with the side and the players they've got. And then inevitably fell apart. They went and won 4-0. And it feels like a side that when we do go 1-0 down, then that's it. And that's obviously really difficult coming to City. We've got Chelsea at the weekend too. With these games, the point to Arsenal is actually undervalued by many Blues, because you simply have that agenda that you want him gone. You want him changed as quick as possible. And I'm in that category of Everton fans. I want him gone. I want somebody else brought in. But you have to have the context of what anybody who comes in will be able to do with Everton at the moment. Certainly think that the one thing that is the is many people are looking at is just the style of football. Simply when you go in to get a few, you know, some value for the few quid you're paying for your ticket, and that's where things are ultimately right now, Dave. With the, it doesn't feel to me, I get criticised a lot for my general way in which I view Everton's really negative. In case anyone hasn't seen what goes on social media, but I have to say, it feels a little bit more comfortable, and this might be just tempting fate, but it feels much more comfortable this season so far. But again, like I say, that's probably referring more to the bottom three. You've got Ipswich, Southampton look like they're already gone. Ipswich look like they're going to be the Luton of last season, and Leicester look like they may stay up. But then you've got a few sides down there as well. I know Palace won the weekend, but you've got a couple of others down there who are sort of looking over the shoulders as well. So again, it looks like three behind us rather than, you know, Everton fighting well above it and going to a mid-table security. And that's where we are up to now. Can't score goals. But defensively, it's doing what Sean Dyche does. He's made a living based on a back four that he keeps as rigid and as solid as possible. That is Sean Dyche. But that is why Sean Dyche is so limited as a manager, and he won't end up going anywhere better than Everton. I'm not saying that waving me Everton flag, but I hope you understand what I mean by that in terms of...
Yeah.
He won't go to a bigger, more positive, more aside with more of an emphasis on doing something more than just simply staying in the Premier League.
Yeah, it's interesting though, because as downbeat as you can be about that style of play, you know, City this season have found it really, really difficult, one, to break down defences, and if you are compact and you're tight, it could be really hard for City to break down. But at the same time, if you've got anything on the counter-attack, then City have looked vulnerable as well. So, like, where do you see this one going on Boxing Day?
Yeah, I mean, I think the inevitability would be that we go there and get absolutely battered, or maybe similar to Man United. You go there, do all right for half hour, and then when City have broken you over, that's all she wrote. But I do have a different feeling with this one. I think that given the way City have gone about things recently, I know it's, what is it, 1-11?
Yeah,
which is remarkable, really. I think
worst run of form since I've been doing this podcast. I started in 2009.
That's extraordinary. That, and obviously, City, and obviously much spoken about and criticised for the amount of money City have gone through. But that is remarkable.
It's ridiculous, isn't it? Yeah.
What's that? How many years is that? 15 years ago?
Yeah, this is the 16th season we're doing it. Yeah,
unbelievable. And I think Sean Dyche will look at this a little bit similar to what we did at Arsenal. It's just frustrates. It sits on pretty much sit on the edge of your 6-yard box in the end of it, and going the other direction, it's really non-existent. You're throwing Calvert-Lewin up there. He might put Brozier in as well, who's looked half decent when he's come on. That'd be a seismic change for what Sean Dyche does in terms of taking Calvert-Lewin out. I think one game he dared to put Better One start him instead of Calvert-Lewin, which quite randomly he decided to put Calvert-Lewin on quite quickly because Better was doing absolutely nothing. Just somebody who can hold the ball up, that'll be our only answer there, getting into your half of the pitch. So, you know, he's going there playing for a draw. Not just a draw, a 0-0 draw, simply put, because if City go 1-0 up here, it's not going to be like that season where we got the equaliser with Damari Gray, scored that absolute worldie. It won't be anything like that, because I simply just don't think he sets up that way. Certainly when he's working behind closed doors, he won't be setting up that way, because priorities in these games, obviously, is not losing them, rather than trying to go there and surprise people and get a win there. Again, which indicates is the common theme we've spoken about so far, is the limitation he has as a manager. So,
even with how City have been playing recently?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I don't think that falls into any context with the way we've been. Do you know, it's really interesting you say that, because if that's an Everton of old, and I'm talking Moyes, I'm talking...
Oh, Moyes beat City every week anyway, it didn't matter. Yeah, exactly. He could do anything, yeah.
There was that. There was, you know, Martinez. If you go to Koeman, obviously Ancelotti was a hero with us for 18 months. You go to those managers and you're thinking they're looking at going away to City and seeing, you know, there's a big fish to be caught there, and they relish this game, thinking that they could go and take City and take 3 points away from City because of the situation City are currently in. It's 180 degree opposite to that with Sean Dyche. I mean, he treats these games as if it's one of the best 3 points he's ever gained in his career if he goes there and gets a 0-0 draw. That's not to be overly criticised given the opponent we've got, even given the situation City are in right now. With you know Pep seeming like there's a different story on the newspapers every single day about him, that doesn't change the way Everton are going to set this up, sadly, because he's that much of it in his own bubble. He'll just refer this to, well, Manchester City have got Erling Haaland, Manchester City have got Doku, a massive fan of him. You know, when Grealish is finally getting some game time, he'll be looking at that more so of what their careers have been like, who they are as players, what they're able to do in front of goal. Nothing else will change apart from his perception of that, rather than what's going on in and around there. And look, I get that. That is sort of keeping that sort of element of safety that you want as a manager. I understand that, particularly going away to, you know, the league winners 4 years on the run. I understand that. But at the end of the day, I think I've said this to many fans of other clubs, looking at Everton, if you're Pep Guardiola and you go in on a Monday morning or Tuesday morning, whatever it is, when you see the lads, you have your training session in the afternoon, you have a look ahead at the opponent you've got, I don't think it would take longer than 10-15 minutes for him to sit in front of the squad, get the projector out and say, this is how Everton play. And there's literally nothing else. There's nothing you could look at that and say, right, you're going to do this. There's any sort of a special area in which you need to stop Everton that's been something that they've done well. And there's nothing that you can look at that will surprise you. And I don't think it takes long for any team against us to simply see what they have to do to stop Everton from scoring a goal. And you look at the many goals scored, it's quite sad. I think there's only one other club. I think it's Southampton's the only team that's scored less than us so far this season. So that shows that if City to break us down, go 1-0 up, Everton won't be coming away with anything from the Etihad.
Yeah. Got the charity bet, Dave, coming up. What are you going to go for this one?
Do you know what, mate? Every time we do this, I always say you're going to batter Everton. But, and I'm invariably right, and I know I'm talking to City fans, so I'm going to go 3-0 to Manchester City.
You're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast. You've made it this far, so don't give up now.
That was David Downey from the Blue Room. Kieran, the other side of this as well, we talked a little bit in the Villa stuff there about we don't know who the personnel is going to be. Does Guardiola have much of a choice at this at the moment? Is there a case for going, yeah, okay, I accept that, you know, the inexperience of these players means that we might be more vulnerable in this one game. But if we, you know, if we play in midfield, that includes Jacob Wright, if we include Nico O'Reilly in there, there is an opportunity for players to have some rest.
Yeah, see, I've seen a lot of calls for people to, you know, to sort of blood a lot of the youngsters, and I can see why he's not done that. And I think like in other years, like when we've had like mini sort of blips, not crises, he's taken a couple of games to like figure things out. Like, you know, we remember when he played Bernardo at left back, for example, and then he ended up going to three at the back and he eventually sorted it out. But I think with how few players are available, I think he needs to look at something like that. I wouldn't be in favour of putting all of the youngsters in together because I think that's just sending lambs out to the slaughter. Mm. But continuing to have, you know, both Gundogan and a really, really tired Bernardo in midfield, it just isn't working. So he needs to try at least something different to change it up. Whether that's Grealish in the middle, like in a much deeper role, just to give us some legs, I don't know. But I would be in favour of introducing the youngsters, but definitely not all at once, which I've seen quite a few people call for.
Yeah, because the other side of this as well, Dan, is you look at players like Vardiol, for instance. You said about why not just clear it off the line. He's obviously struggling at the moment. There's obviously a great player in there, but he needs some time out of the team, basically. And they've not been able to afford to give him that. Is there a case for like just going, okay, well, if we play Walker and Lewis as the fullbacks, Simpson-Pusey, in you go?
Why not, to be honest with you? I mean, I've been a bit resistant to the kind of throw the kids in mentality until the last week or so as well, really. You just think, yeah, why not give him a go? I mean, I think James McAtee deserves a start at some point, you know, having stayed around in the summer when I'm sure he probably could have left if he wanted to, you know, and perhaps being given some assurances about his playing time this year that haven't been met, though, you know, those promises haven't been kept. I think give him a go. Come on, you know, what harm can it do at this point, really? You know, we're probably going to lose a few more games in the next few weeks. I don't see us going on a winning run anytime soon. We're going to drop points. Let's at least do it so that the players that are really struggling, like you say, can have a bit of a rest and then can come back stronger in the new year, I would say.
Yeah. Villa, while hit and miss, would go above City with a win. Everton at the Etihad, meanwhile, Casey, that really needs to be a home win, doesn't it? How does that happen?
I don't know because I've got bad memories of Everton at Christmas. Like, do you remember there was a year where we could have been top at Christmas, but Everton beat us at home?
Yeah.
And
like minus 12 that day as well. Oh, it's horrible.
It was so cold that game. Like, I think, did Bain score a screamer with his right foot as well in that game?
Probably. And, yeah. And it was probably Tim Cahill as well, wasn't it? Always was.
Yeah, I think Tim Cahill had left, but the ghost of him still scored.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just think it depends on the Villa game. I think the situation that we're in now, I don't think we can actually judge absolutely anything for the Everton game until we see the Villa game. Because the game, and I know the games are coming thick and fast in terms of, you know, we need to review it for the podcast schedule. But I don't think I can form an opinion on that game until we see how we perform at Villa. Mm. Because if it's another performance like Sunday, then you just think, well, where do we actually go from there?
Where's the next point coming from, yeah.
Yeah, and especially, like, again, Everton aren't, the way that Dyche has sort of, you know, got, you know, sort of turned the mentality around a little bit for Everton this season. Because, you know, if you think back to the start of this year, when they were getting beat every, you know, they were getting, did they concede three against, was it Bournemouth or Brentford? I always get them mixed up, but it was Bournemouth or Brentford scored three in like the past 5 minutes. So if we were playing that version of Everton, then you'd be saying, even with our poor form, we'd be absolutely fine. But you just think, Dyche in the cold, rainy Boxing Day, you know, you just
had a point at the Emirates as well.
Yeah.
You could just imagine him. You know, that mentality that Dyche should build up around, that, you know, everyone sort of hates us, that sort of thing. They're not going to like it out there, and I don't think we will like it out there if it's a really cold, horrible Boxing Day. So yeah, I'm not too hopeful for it either, to be honest with you. But then again, if we play well out of nowhere against Villa, and Sunday does turn out to be the turning point, then you'd be a lot more hopeful. Yeah. But it's just hard to know what to make of anything at the minute, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, how about this from John, Dan, who says, the longer this run goes on, do you think there's a danger that Pep could think that he's the change that is needed and that it's time for him to go? I can't see the club sacking him, but do you think he'd walk? Then where would we be?
That was another feeling I had after the game on Sunday, actually, a sort of slight fear that might happen. And then I listened to Let Me Talk podcast where you discussed this. Very good podcast, by the way. Better than this one. and I think Sam Lee was spot on in that maybe in a moment of weakness, Pep might think about something like that and will just be talked round by the club into not doing it, and will probably sleep on it and go, actually, yeah. And I think the fact that he signed that contract just before this run went on, I think he knew a run like this was coming, perhaps not this bad, but I think he knew when he signed that contract that there was problems that weren't going to be solved anytime soon, and that he wanted to be the person to solve them and rebuild the club a little bit and leave the club in good shape. So no, I think it would have to be extremely bad, and I'm talking, like, you know, 2 months without a win or something, for him to go, hang on, this is a real problem now.
I think his pride would come into it, like you say as well. I don't think he'd want to leave us in the state that we're in now, would he?
No. I think he's driven by the idea of turning it around now, I think, and rebuilding his own reputation, which, you know, his reputation is untouchable for me. If we get relegated under him this season somehow, I don't think you can, you know, say that the last 5, 6, 7 years count for nothing, can you really? You know, he's got nothing to prove for me.
Yeah, exactly. Right, well, we've had no winners on the charity bet for a while now, so we remain on £715 for the season. William Hill has given us 3 £10 correct score singles, and the winnings are going to the Man City Fans Food Bank Support Group. It's Villa and Everton to predict. As KC says, we just don't really know what to expect from City at the moment, so good luck, everyone. Frankie has gone for a 2-2 draw at Villa Park. That's 11-1 and £110 if he's right. KC, what are you having?
This is how bad it is at the moment. I've sacked off my usual 6-1 prediction, and I've gone for two. I'm still hopeful. I've gone for a 2-1 win.
2-1 City win, 8-1 and £80 if you're right. Dan, you're feeling altogether less confident, I gather.
The scenes when we win 6-1 this weekend now.
I know.
God, I would cry. I would cry.
It's got 2-0 Villa written all over it for me.
Well, if it happens, it's 20-1 and £200 for the charity, if you're right. That brings us to Everton. We heard from David Downey earlier. He's gone for a 3-0 City win. That's 15-2 and £75 if he's right. Dan, what are you having?
Slightly more confident 2-1 win for City.
2-1 City is also 15-2 and £75. KC wanted 2-1 as well, so I had to I had to get him to give me a second one. What have you gone for?
I've gone for a Desmond 2-2.
2-2 is 22-1 and £220 if you are right. Remember, you've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. And for information on how to gamble responsibly, take a look at begambleaware.org.
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer. Statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statcity.co.uk and browse away. That's statcity.co.uk.
Ad-free episodes are available on Patreon. Sign up at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Let's have one of Higgy's jingles. KC, pick a number, 1, 2 or 3.
3, please.
Number 3, here we go.
Have you got a theory on City that needs closer inspection? Or just something to ask us? Because this is your section. Read something odd into Pep's tone or inflection? Or a novel idea to improve team selection? Sick of these jingles? Well, give it a mention, or maybe something worthwhile to bring to our attention. Let us know, Blues, because it's your listeners' questions. Oh, yes, it really is.
It really is indeed.
Twitter, he's got a bit Frank Sidebottom there, hasn't he?
Yes, yeah. But I don't know. I don't know if we're going to get any more from him. I think we're just going to get the 3 now and have them on rotation.
The trilogy.
All the best things come in trilogies, don't they? None of this kind of extra sequels nonsense. Twitter and Blue Sky, you can get in touch at Blue Moon Podcast. You can email contact@bluemoonpodcast.com as well, or you can go onto the website bluemoonpodcast.com, fill in the form there. It does work. I have tested it now. This is an idea that has come in from KC a few weeks ago, and the irony is that we're doing it on the show that he's on. But it's a discussion that it came from a discussion on Stick to Football, didn't it, KC, about the best players of certain eras?
Yeah, basically. Well, obviously, you're always looking for ideas when it's slow weeks or international football and stuff like that, so that we've got stuff to talk about. So I sent it, yeah, and I think it was just after the last international break, and I thought, well, the next international break, not realising that this run of form was going to be coming, where we'd desperately try and talk about the United game as little as possible, so we could talk about something more fun. So that was the idea behind it.
Yeah, so I've broken it down into several eras going back to our childhoods. Sorry to a few older listeners who might want us to go back a bit further, but we're not going to. And it's basically a discussion of who is the best player of each era. So we're going to start with the Joe Royal promotion era. So about 1998 to about 2000. KC, who is the best player of that era for you?
The best player... probably, and I know you had the interview. Like, I really like Mark Kennedy's season. I thought he was absolutely quality for us. But overall, it's probably between Andy Morrison and Sean Gotter, isn't it? I think
I'm all for it being Mark Kennedy. You know,
yeah. Mark, but obviously, he was. You know, he wasn't here for that. Well, I suppose it is only a short era that we're talking about. But yet, Mark Kennedy was probably the best player that we had in that short space of time. I don't know what you think, Dan.
I was tempted to say Kennedy as well. I would say the GOAT for me. I think his goals fired us to that second promotion more and perhaps had more of an influence than anyone else. Andy Morrison was influential in that promotion season from the third division, but then was injured for quite a lot of the next 2 years, wasn't he? Kevin Horlock, I think, is in the conversation as well, just for kind of consistency.
Can I chuck another name in there, which is obviously very me, but Nicky Weaver?
Yeah.
Nicky Weaver's a good shout. But
Dickov deserves a mention as well.
Yeah, but I'd say, I completely forgot. I'd say, Horlock is a great shout, Dan. Horlock was absolutely superb for us.
Mm. Yeah. Well, that carries on then into the Kevin Keegan and Stuart Pearce era, because I've kind of grouped these two together, because you've got that Keegan promotion, but that's kind of just a season. And then the final season at Main Road kind of blends into that as well. But then over the next kind of few years, City kind of just existed in the Premier League for a bit, which I guess makes it quite a difficult decision on this one. So, Dan, when you consider that era where City were not really threatened by relegation, but also not really threatening to do anything else under Keegan and Pearce, who were the better players there?
I mean, Bernabe is the obvious answer, I think. Just
and
for
Berkovic.
Bernabe and Berkovic in that promotion season. I think if you would say the actual best player in terms of talent over the Keegan era, it's probably Anelka.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Pearce era, everyone was shit, weren't they, really? Like, Joey Barton was probably the best player, but they were all shite. So it's hard to really say.
Yeah, I feel like you've lumped the Pearce era in purely just to get it out of the way. I think we just avoid Pearce completely and just talk about the Keegan era.
Okay.
Yeah, because everyone was shit under Pearce. Well, apart from, he did have a good run when he first started, but I'd say Anelka is obviously the most talented. And then, Ali B and Berkovic. But yeah, I think we had quite a lot of, players that had very good moments in and around that time, even though, like you say, David, we were just sort of, in a sort of safety buffer zone around that time, weren't we?
Yeah. What about we'll take that for the Keegan era, but for the Pearce era, what about, given that as much as City couldn't score goals, they were all right defensively?
Dunn
how about
Sylvain
Distan? Distan.
Oh, yeah, true.
Yeah. Dunn and Distan were great together, but I suppose they were the only ones that had the real quality. So was it 4 years on the bounce that Richard Dunn got Player of the Year?
Yeah.
So, it has to be worth a mention on that alone, doesn't it?
Yeah, true. Yeah.
I'm going to lump kind of the Sven and first period of Hughes era in together and kind of make it the Taksin Sinawatra era. So who's the best player of that, Casey?
I think it's between three, Alano, Petrov and Michael Johnson for me. Them three just seems to give us a lot of hope altogether at the start of that season. Mm. Like there was a lot of good, obviously I think Corluka for his season was good and stuff like that. But Alano, Petrov and Michael Johnson were the players that got you up out of your seat then, weren't they?
I mean, all three of those names, they sort of burned bright, didn't they? And then faded quite quickly, unfortunately. So it's quite a tricky one to answer. I actually thought Vincent Kompany for this one. I know it wasn't really his era, but he was signed in this era. He played midfield in that Hughes season. And just the fact he was signed in that era, really, and we got him for a bargain price and went on to be like the club captain and win loads of trophies and stuff. That was kind of my instinct on this one. But it's completely Alano. I love watching him for half a season there, where he was quite good. And Petrov as well. And, even like Emelian Penza and players like that in that time were quite good, weren't they?
I'd have wanted Penza to be in the conversation, but ultimately just didn't play enough. He just wasn't in the team enough, was he?
Stevie Ireland deserves a mention as well, I think, actually.
But to be fair, across the last couple as well, like my favourite player, but he wasn't the better, like Richards. I loved Richards around that time as well.
Mm. Yeah, he really came into his own though, Casey, in what I've termed the Roberto Mancini era. Because I honestly, when Mancini arrived at City, I thought, well, Richards is never really going to make it. He doesn't really have what it takes to get to the next level. Mancini got hold of him, and bang, there he was, next level.
I thought Richards was really good, and it's like people often think that Zabaleta was the main right back in that first title winning season, but he wasn't. It was Richards for the majority of the season. It's just Zaba got in for the last six games and Mancini didn't want to change his team.
He basically Zabaleta played that QPR game ultimately because Mancini was superstitious.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
yeah. Yeah. So, who was the best player of that era, though, KC? Because it's probably not Richards. He had a good time in that era, but probably not Richards as the best player.
It's David Silva and Yaya Toure, isn't it?
Yeah.
Honourable mention to Gareth Barry as well, though. Gareth Barry was superb.
If you had to pick, Dan,
Silva just has the edge for me. Yeah. I think, yeah.
Yeah. When you move forward then into the Pellegrini era, Dan, does a player like Sergio Aguero start to come into the conversation for that one?
He does, yeah. I think this was his time, wasn't it, really? I mean, obviously, we had the QPR game and he was great that season as well. But I think under Pellegrini and in those few years was when he really went up a gear and really started, you know, establishing himself as one of the best strikers in Premier League history, if not world football, you know. So that was my answer for this one as well, Aguero.
It definitely is Aguero, but I think Fernandinho's worth a mention for how good he was during that period. Even when, you know, we dipped off towards the end of Pellegrini, Fernandinho never did he? He was always brilliant.
He was a big part of... we then come to Guardiola's management time, and I've split this into two eras. The first one we're going to go for is the 2017 to 2019 two seasons, those two title wins. Obviously, 100 points, 98 points, Dan. It was two incredible teams there over two seasons. Who stands out as the best player?
Kevin De Bruyne.
Yeah. That's it. I was going to say exactly the same. Yeah.
Doesn't even. I mean, you, even when you consider like the volume of goals that Aguero and Sterling got in there, the play from David Silva, it's still De Bruyne.
In that period, yeah. Even though for me, David Silva's the best player that's ever played for us. Still, it's clearly Kevin from that point. I think he just completely takes over the mantle at that point, and he sort of made the team his own, didn't he?
That was just his peak, wasn't it? I think really, whereas Silva was maybe a bit past his peak by the time Pep got here. You know, maybe Phil Foden is, maybe he comes a bit later. I don't know actually, but like Aguero again, a bit past his peak by the time Pep comes. I think 2017, 2019, 20 was just De Bruyne at his absolute best. So that's the answer for me.
That's him. And then the final era I've split it into. I've taken out this season because it's not particularly becoming to say that Matías Núñez is your best player of this season's era. And also the 1920 season where things kind of fell apart a bit for Guardiola. So we've gone for the four in a row era, which is actually quite hard because as much as it feels like the team hasn't changed that much over those four seasons. The team that played in that first title win compared to the one that played in the last one is actually quite different. So for that four seasons, who stands out as the best player, Dan?
That's Rodri for me, yeah. I would say. Yeah, quite comfortably. I mean, Gundogan was another one that I thought for this period in time, just the sort of influence that he had, especially towards the end of the seasons. And again, Foden you might throw in as one who's come into the fore, especially in the last couple of years. But yeah, I think for, you know, his first season aside, and maybe a bit of his second season aside, Rodri has just been phenomenal.
Yeah, it's when it gets to the point where you can't win without him, Casey, it kind of makes the decision for you, doesn't it? And he's the only Ballon d'Or winner at City as well.
Yeah, he's just an immense player, isn't he? But yeah, it's Rodri head and shoulders. But like Dan said, Gundogan and then to a lesser extent Foden, a distant second and third, I think, behind just how good Rodri's been.
That was the podcast equivalent of that tweet where it's like, guys can have the best time just sitting around naming old sports players.
True. I mean,
That was why I was surprised that you started with the Royal era and we were just sitting around talking about Gary Flitcroft and Steve Wilmot.
Well, but I did think about that, but I was trying not to make this podcast too long as well. But I used to have, do you remember back in the day, Tumblr was the blog of choice for people. I used to have a Tumblr blog that was just, it was called something like Random Former Manchester City Players. And I'd schedule loads of posts where it's just a photograph of a player from like the 90s and noughties that would just post automatically. And one of the City supporting journos saw it and was just like posted it on Twitter and was just like, this is fantastic. I don't know who set this up, but this is fantastic. And it is just guys sitting around naming old players.
Yeah. That's can't cheered be, me right yeah. up, that. Yeah. This is why lockdown was actually underrated, because we didn't have to watch City and we could just remember the good old days, couldn't we?
Yeah.
Bring on another lockdown right now. Immediately. Immediately, that's what I say. Yeah. That's it for this week's Blue Moon Podcast. Thank you very much for listening, and thanks to my guests for this one, KC.
Cheers, mate.
And Dan Burke.
My pleasure.
Keep an eye on your feeds because we'll be back on Christmas Day with the annual Christmas quiz as Adam Carter, Chris Higginbottom, Dom Farrell and Richard Burns battle it out to be this year's festive champion. There's a clip of this week's Nostalgia Show coming up shortly too. That was City Heaven, City Hell, and it was focusing on games with Reading. If you want the full thing, you can check out patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. It's just £2 per month to sign up. We'll be back after the game with Everton. See you then.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
When I look back on that sort of 2 weeks, it makes me feel ill. We shouldn't have sacked Roberto Mancini. We'd won the league for the first time in 44 years the year before. We finished second to Manchester United the following year, despite the manager not getting any of the signings that he wanted. We got some not just below par signings, but real, real substandard signings that summer. Yes, there have been reports about the fact that the players hated him, or large chunks of the players hated him. You often like to think that these relationships can be mended rather than a manager who's done so much for us losing his job. But we went to Reading, and yeah, it was awful. It was completely after the Lord Mayor's show. It was like restarting a football match when you've just conceded the sixth with 10 minutes to go, or being a sub, being brought on as a sub when your team is 6-0 down and being asked to make yourself look busy up front, that kind of thing. It was just one of those games. But what I would say is, and having attended the match, that was one of our best performances of the season.
Yeah, I was going to say, they played really well.
It was vintage Manchester City of that era.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. And join us again next time for another episode.